I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's June 2nd, and we have a lot to talk about. In fact, we have so much to talk about that this episode of Real Talk MS is going to run a little long, but I hope you'll find that this episode still gives you a good return on your investment of time, because today we have not one, but two interviews to get to, along with the news that you should know about. Massachusetts General Hospital is not only the third oldest general hospital in the United States, it's also the largest teaching hospital at Harvard Medical School. And this past April, Massachusetts General Hospital partnered with iConquer MS, the people-powered MS research network, to conduct a survey of the impact of COVID-19 on people living with MS. They surveyed just over 1,000 people living with multiple sclerosis, and today I'll be joined by Dr. Farah Mateen from Massachusetts General Hospital and Holly Schmidt from iConquer MS, and we'll be among the first to hear some of the key takeaways from their survey. And while we're on the subject of COVID-19 and MS, what's most clear about the Massachusetts General Hospital and iConquer MS survey is that people affected by MS are worried, as is most everyone else. That's why I'm so happy to have Dr. Amy Sullivan joining us today to talk about maintaining our emotional wellness during this time of added stress and uncertainty. Dr. Sullivan is a clinical health psychologist and the director of behavioral medicine at the Mellon Center for MS Treatment and Research at the Cleveland Clinic. She's a good friend of the Real Talk MS community, so I'm especially pleased to be able to welcome her back to the podcast. But before we get to the survey results with Dr. Farah Mateen and Holly Schmidt, and before we get into some steps that you can take to offset those feelings of isolation and anxiety with Dr. Amy Sullivan, there are a few other things that you should know about. Last Saturday, May 30th, was World MS Day. Each year, World MS Day gives the global MS community an opportunity to come together to focus awareness on multiple sclerosis and to celebrate hope for the future. And when I look at the wins that we're seeing in MS research and the evidence-based benefits that we now know can be gained by making smart lifestyle choices like choosing to stop smoking, adding exercise and physical activity to your daily routine, using mindfulness meditation and paying attention to nutrition, well, it feels like we have a lot of reasons to celebrate hope. Now, if you happen to listen to last week's podcast episode, you heard me mention that coinciding with World MS Day, I'd be announcing a partnership that I think will go a long way toward changing the face of MS research and involving people affected by MS in ways that they've never been involved in research before. And if you're a member of our Real Talk MS Facebook group, then you saw a video preview of that announcement before anyone else did. But I want to share this announcement with all of you and also add a couple of details to it. As a member of the International Progressive MS Alliance's Scientific Steering Committee, I announced a partnership between the Alliance and MultiACT. MultiACT is the European Union's initiative to increase the impact of neurological disease research, and multiple sclerosis will be the first MultiACT case study. Now, MultiACT has a few different components, but the aspect of MultiACT that I believe is a game changer for patients is the MultiACT framework for patient engagement in research. While collecting patient data has always been important in MS research, the MultiACT guidelines for patient engagement require that patients be fully engaged in all the relevant decision-making stages of a research initiative. This means that people affected by MS are made part of every stage of an MS research project, from having input into the actual goals of the project, to having a voice in the design of a clinical trial, to recruiting participants for a trial, all the way through to evaluating the outcome once a study has ended and sharing the results with the rest of the world. MultiAct is going to connect people affected by MS and researchers in new, more powerful ways. And I believe that increased level of engagement is going to improve the quality of MS research while accelerating access to life-changing treatments. In other words, I think this is game-changing news. And I'm especially looking forward to seeing the International Progressive MS Alliance adopt the MultiAct framework in the research projects that we support. So stay tuned for future updates on how MultiAct is transforming MS research. And if you'd like to review the announcement itself or learn more about MultiAct, I'll include a link to more information in today's show notes. Last week, the European Academy of Neurology's annual scientific congress was turned into a virtual congress, and in doing so, became the largest neurology meeting in history, with more than 42,000 people virtually attending. During the congress, Atara Biotherapeutics made an encouraging announcement about the progress that they're seeing during their Phase 1 clinical trial of their potential immunotherapy known as ATA188. Now, if you're a longtime listener, you might remember that last fall at the ECTRIMS conference, I met up with Dr. A.J. Joshi, the chief medical officer at Atara Biotherapeutics, and we talked about ATA188, which is their cell therapy that's designed to attack B cells in the immune system that have been infected with the Epstein-Barr virus. Now, there are many experts who believe that if you can eliminate the Epstein-Barr virus, you can eliminate most multiple sclerosis. And that's the theory behind this ATA188 treatment, that attacking the Epstein-Barr virus is a viable path to mitigating MS. And Atara Biotherapeutics' clinical trial is specifically looking at the benefit of ATA188 for people living with primary progressive and secondary progressive MS. So at the European Academy of Neurology virtual conference, Atara Biotherapeutics presented data that showed that the therapy was safe and well-tolerated in people with progressive MS, and that ATA188 induced a sustained reduction in disability among people who were given higher doses. Now, the second part of the Phase 1 trial will continue with all of the participants receiving this higher dose of ATA188. So, as I said, this is encouraging news. And now I'll add my standard disclaimer that these results are from an early stage of this clinical trial, and there's a considerable amount of work ahead. However, these results are still notable because they are encouraging, and they serve to remind us that so far, the research team is headed down a promising path. And that's good news with or without any disclaimers. And it's also encouraging to see that recruitment for this study is back on track after being paused due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll continue to watch for future announcements about progress in this clinical trial. And if you'd like to review the details of this study or see if you might be a participant in the study, I'll include a link in today's show notes. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound impact on everyone, whether or not they happen to be affected by multiple sclerosis. But for people who are affected by MS, it's raised all sorts of concerns about whether they should change their disease-modifying therapy, or stop their disease-modifying therapy, or cancel their infusion appointments or their follow-up appointments with their neurologist. But to get a real sense of how the pandemic has impacted people affected by MS, you really need to go beyond the one-off anecdotes and stories that you happen to hear. And that's what a very nimble research team headed up by Dr. Farah Mateen from Massachusetts General Hospital and Holly Schmidt from iConquer MS did. By mobilizing the iConquer MS people-powered MS research network, Dr. Mateen and Ms. Schmidt were able to survey more than 1,000 people living with MS about how they've been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And while just a very small handful of the survey respondents were actually diagnosed with COVID-19, it seems as though everyone has been affected in one way or another. And as you'll hear, Some survey respondents have been positively affected by this forced time out in our lives. In a moment, we'll review the details of this survey with my guests, Dr. Farah Mateen and Holly Schmidt. If you're a regular listener, then you've been following our ongoing conversation about the impact of COVID-19 on people living with MS. The medical community is learning about the interaction of COVID-19 and MS in real time, and as new information is uncovered, I try to share it with you in real time. So you might remember that we talked about a survey that was being conducted by iConquerMS and investigator Dr. Farah Mateen from Massachusetts General Hospital about the impact of COVID-19 on people living with MS. The online survey captured information during the month of April from more than 1,000 people living with MS in 24 countries across 6 continents. Although for the sake of clarification, I should also mention that about 88% of the survey respondents were from the United States. My guests today are Holly Schmidt, the Vice President of Scientific Operations at the Accelerated Cure Project for Multiple Sclerosis, and iConquerMS is the Accelerated Cure Project's people-powered MS research network. And we're also joined by Dr. Farah Mateen. Dr. Mateen is an associate professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, where she's also the director of global health in the Department of Neurology. And Dr. Mateen sees patients as a member of the Department of Neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Mateen has traveled to more than 35 countries and published more than 140 academic manuscripts to advance neurological disease research and clinical care. Holly and Dr. Mateen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
I guess we can start at the very beginning of your survey. And Dr. Mateen, what was the key question that you wanted this survey to answer?
So it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me, and thanks for having Holly. This is really a collaborative effort to understand what we consider to be knowledge, attitudes, and practices of people with MS. And it was inspired mostly by people living with MS. We started having a lot of questions, a lot of concerns. And we wanted to know, how do people with MS, how are they navigating the epidemic? So whether they had exposure to coronavirus or not, we wanted to know, if you had MS, what was your experience?
And Holly, can you give us a kind of an overview of some of the findings from the survey?
Oh, sure. I'm happy to. So some of the things that we asked about had to do with a topic that Farah brought in, which was, you know, what do people know about the coronavirus, people in our network, people with MS, and, you know, what are they doing about it? So what are their social distancing, or their quarantining, or their, you know, washing their hands? What are their practices that they're taking to help prevent their own exposure and prevent the spread of the virus? We also were interested in knowing what effect the virus was having on people's healthcare. So are they limiting their healthcare visits? Are they making any changes to their disease-modifying therapies? Are they nervous about going to the hospital or to the doctor? We wanted to know about that as well. And we also wanted to know about effects on their quality of life. So how has the virus affected their employment? And how has it affected their financial status and their ability to exercise and to get, you know, maintain their diet or get access to food? So there's a wide range of findings from that. And I thought, Farah, if you wanted to talk about some of the quantitative findings, so some of the facts and figures from the study, and then maybe I could share some of the findings that we had from the open response questions, so where we ask people to write in their own words an answer to a question.
So that sounds great. So we had a fairly comprehensive survey. So we thanked all the participants who put their time into this, and we really got a very rich data source from this. And the timing, I think, was really important. So the Accelerated Cure Project was so exquisitely poised to answer this question because they had a network of people who were already engaged. And so right at the height of the epidemic, what we hope is that was the height of the epidemic and cresting downwards now, we asked over 1,000 people with MS a variety of questions that Holly alluded to. So I can tell you some of the highlights. The actual final manuscript is several thousand words, so we won't go through all the details. But just to put this in context, the average age of the respondent was 54. 79% were women. This is a survey only to adults. As you mentioned, approximately 90% are from the U.S., representing 49 of the 50 states, so just missing Alaska. And about 75% took a disease-modifying therapy. So we understand this to be a fairly representative group of people living with MS in the U.S. 41% had depression, 26% had hypertension, 12% had asthma. To get to the coronavirus-specific information, actually, we only had 7 people say that they had actually had COVID-19. A small fraction had been tested, so really a very small number. So the anxiety and the worry level was very high as a group. But in terms of the number of people tested, it was under 1%. The number of people who had been exposed was similar. The 96% of people had not been tested, and of those people, most of them didn't want to be tested. We know that this has been an issue in the U.S., access to testing, but a lot of people didn't want to be tested and were worried about actually going in to get the test. 10% of folks said that they had already made a change to their disease-modifying therapy dose or schedule, which as a neurologist, of course, is very important because it has impacts not just during the epidemic, but potentially long afterwards. A lot of people had done so without the input of their neurologist. So hopefully everybody will sort of coalesce in the future on their decision making. But in the short term, a lot of people were making their own decisions. There's a lot of concern about going into the hospital, as mentioned. Some people that manifested as not getting screening labs or not getting MRIs. 64% of participants reported canceling or postponing medical visits. 34% of them were for a neurologist specifically. In terms of degree of worry, we did that graphically on scales, but overall the degree of worry was well above the mean. Usually it was approximately like 5 out of 7.
I want to circle back to a couple of the statistics you shared with us. You mentioned that there were the most common comorbidities, I think, were depression, hypertension, and was the third diabetes?
Asthma.
Asthma. Okay.
Asthma.
Yep. And I guess I'm asking because one of the things that other researchers are learning is that while having MS isn't necessarily a factor that increases someone's likelihood of contracting COVID-19 or in determining the severity of COVID-19 should they contract it, it's really the comorbidities that people living with MS may have that more accurately determine whether they're actually considered at a higher risk. So these comorbidities become important in this case, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just drawing upon my clinical experience here as well, but one of the things I always tell people in my practice is, you know, to try and keep it, you know, a healthy diet and exercise, but also like if you're smoking cigarettes, absolutely stop for so many reasons that relate to MS, related to disability outcomes. But also I think we're learning in this case that, you know, 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2 all the time. It might equal, you know, 5. And so you don't want to have synergistic risk factors playing out here. 5% of our respondents had diabetes as well. And so we know those multi-morbidity situations can be very risky for people in general. So with immunosuppression in context, you really have to maximize all of the comorbidity reduction that you can.
I think the other thing that I heard that certainly struck a chord was the survey respondents who made changes to their disease-modifying therapy without consulting with their neurologist. And while I can understand someone having some real reservations about going to a hospital to keep an appointment, there are other ways to do that, especially now. We see telehealth taking giant leaps that we've never seen before. And certainly to have a conversation about disease-modifying therapy, that's an easy telehealth or even phone call appointment, isn't it?
Right, or even a message in. And so I know a couple of things have already been reported. So neurologists and physicians are not great estimators of people's adherence. So physicians tend to overestimate people's adherence to medicines. That's been well reported in the literature. But I think what COVID-19 has done, at least in my practice, I think in a lot of other practices around the country and even around the world, is that it is it's made some things more efficient. But it's made, you know, some people also finding it difficult, depending on, you know, who your neurologist is, or maybe they've been redeployed, or maybe their practice is shut or something. Maybe it's difficult for them. So we didn't probe all the reasons why it was without the sort of blessing, if you will, of the neurologist. But it's also made things, I think, accelerated. So, you know, we've adopted telemedicine in our practice quite a bit, but now all of my visits in my clinic today were telemedicine by necessity, whereas only a few months ago, maybe only 10% of them would have been. So the lasting question is, you know, how transformative is this? Is this something that we're going to take and sort of keep hold of and continue to have really good telemedicine and have better access for patients no matter what happens? Like, can this actually change the quality and the type of care MS patients get? And hopefully for the better. But, you know, what can we learn from the COVID-19 story and take away from it from the patient perspective to hopefully make their care better?
Holly, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Some people said that their healthcare providers and their teams have been really fantastic in terms of getting them the information and support that they needed. But more people, I would say, are saying they wish they had more information and support. So, and as Farah said, that lack of information and support could come from a number of different areas. You know, it could be due to a number of different reasons. But in the absence of that, perhaps people are just, you know, having to figure things out on their own and making the decisions that they feel is best.
As you both alluded to, I think that the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed where some of the support systems aren't so well reinforced. For instance, people with MS and other neurological conditions that don't happen to live reasonably close to an urban center, the quality of care available to them is vastly different. They may be hundreds of miles from an MS specialist, for instance, and hopefully telemedicine is going to show us that these are people who can much more easily be reached. And sure, we can't do everything via telemedicine, but we can do so much more than perhaps they're already being availed of even in person, that their quality of care actually increases. So hopefully there'll be one or two positives we can take away from this experience as well.
Yeah, I hope so. We actually did a survey. It was funded by the National MS Society, and it was with Dr. Mitchell Lin from the Veterans Administration on telemedicine in January. So that was before all of the COVID-19, the infections and the awareness and the social distancing started happening. So that was sort of a baseline, if you will. We would love to go and do that survey again to ask people, have you had telemedicine visits? What's your perception of their value? Would you continue to do them, or would you like to do them if you haven't done them yet? And I think we would see a very different outcome if we can repeat the survey, maybe, you know, in a month or two or down the road, because we expect people will have a lot more experience with it, as well as hopefully an appreciation of how it can benefit them.
I hope you're right. And it would give us another opportunity to visit again and talk about how the results of that survey may have changed from January till the next mm-hmm. time you get to do it. But Holly, you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago that in addition to some of these specific quantitative questions, people who responded to the survey also had opportunities to write in, add their own comments. Can you give us an idea of some of the things you found as you went through these open text responses?
Oh, I'd be glad to. And I will say that there is a wealth of information. So we need to figure out exactly how we're going to analyze this data, because it's really important, and also then disseminate it back to the MS community. But we asked some different open-ended questions. We asked about how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected people's daily patterns and their decision making, how it's affected their employment, how they are thinking about the COVID-19 virus and illness in the context of their MS, and a few other things as well. And some of the things that we found are things I think that are universal to everybody who's living through the situation. You know, people in general are more sedentary. They can't go to the gym. They can't even go to their local store and walk around it, which they might have done previously for exercise. They don't have visits with family and friends. Some people are even living in different spaces in their house from their spouses because of, you know, concern about getting coronavirus through work exposures. There's a number of people reported mental health effects, stress, anxiety, depression, isolation, and fear. And those come from a number of different areas. For example, just the constant news or financial hardships or, you know, the stress of having more people at home and having to disinfect everything. So these are all, I think, common across everybody, but then there are also some specific concerns or questions because the people who answered the survey had MS. Some of those questions are, can COVID-19 infections or symptoms trigger an MS attack? What should I do if I have an MS attack during this pandemic? I thought this was a really interesting question. A few people raised it. How do you tell if symptoms like pain or fatigue are due to COVID-19 or MS? Is shortness of breath that I'm experiencing due to COVID-19 or is it an MS hug? People obviously want to know if their disease-modifying therapies affect the risk of COVID-19 or the severity, if they should get it. They want to know if they're on a B-cell depleting therapy, would that affect how well a vaccine would work in them? They've heard that the coronavirus is neurotropic. So what does that mean to somebody who has MS, a neurological disease? And then also, a few people wondered if they were hospitalized due to COVID-19 and the supplies in the hospital were scarce, for example, ventilators, would having MS affect their ability to get those resources? So a lot of very MS-specific questions came through in the open text responses as well as, you know, just people saying these are some effects that I've experienced due to having MS. I have an issue keeping my mobility service dog engaged without the usual activities that we would go through in a day. Or, you know, worried about the impact on support groups or events, which used to get together in person. So there's, we can really tell also, in addition to general effects, that people with MS have effects over and or above and beyond what other people in the community might have.
Was there anything about the survey results that surprised you?
You know, one thing that I was struck by is some of the silver linings that people found. You know, some people who responded to the survey actually said they haven't had many significant changes to their life or their health or their lifestyle. So that's great that not everybody has been impacted. Other people have reported some positive changes. So they've been able to do more walking and in order to get some time away from the people that they're living with. Some people report a stronger spiritual life or having time for new projects or, you know, even things like cleaning the closets. They have time for that now. One person said, I think that this is teaching us all the value of slowing down, which, you know, as Americans living in a busy, productive society, we don't always get to appreciate, but maybe we're appreciating that a bit more. And one person, or probably more than one person, but one I remember said, the restrictions are worth it to get the virus under control. So there's a recognition that even though the restrictions are a hardship and, you know, are causing difficulties for people with a chronic disease like MS, hopefully it will all pay off and we can get the virus taken care of and dealt with and go back to our normal lives before too long.
Not too long ago, I heard someone say that the only thing that's spreading faster than COVID-19 is misinformation about COVID-19. So I appreciate how quickly you've been able to collate these survey results and report on them. let me thank you both for the work that you're each doing to improve the lives of people affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a real privilege.
You probably don't need a survey to tell you that the world's overall anxiety level has been ratcheted up, and the daily stress and anxiety that so many people are experiencing can have a serious impact on our quality of life and even our physical well-being. In a moment, we'll talk about the steps that we can take to overcome those feelings of isolation, depression, and anxiety when we welcome my guest, Dr. Amy Sullivan, back to the podcast. My guest today is Dr. Amy Sullivan. Dr. Sullivan is a clinical health psychologist and the director of behavioral medicine at the Mellon Center for MS Treatment and Research at the Cleveland Clinic. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Sullivan.
Well, thanks so much for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be on your show again. And I know that this is such important information to me. And through our conversations throughout the year, I know this is important to you too. So thanks for having me and giving me the platform to talk about this.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've heard from so many of my listeners that even as their local communities are starting to reopen for business, many people living with MS aren't quite ready to venture out of their homes. And I guess the paradox is that while they stay at home, their feelings of isolation and even depression increase. So they're not really seeing any viable options ahead. What can you recommend?
Well, I think first it's important that we recognize that these are unprecedented times. So when we're thinking about how people are responding to this, well, I don't necessarily know that there's a right way or a wrong way for this. And so people can have a variety of emotions, fear, as you just mentioned. People can have uncertainty, isolation, loneliness, and then they can have gratitude and feeling contentment or maybe even motivated to make changes to their well-being. And so when people are afraid to go out, I think it's first important to just say, okay, these are unprecedented times and none of us really know what's right or wrong. And so just discovering what's best for each person. Each person is going to have a different risk tolerance. And so I think it's important that each person decides on their own and without judgment where their risk tolerance lies.
Resilience is something that people living with MS often hear about because living with uncertainty isn't a new reality for people with MS. They may have more experience than most when it comes to building resilience, but COVID-19 has added a new layer of uncertainty to everyone's lives. And I'm hoping you can share some things that our listeners can do to help build or strengthen their resilience.
So what we know about resiliency is that people who have been through difficult situations tend to have more resiliency. So our MS patients tend to be very resilient. I've said that from the day that I've met most of my patients. This is the most incredibly resilient group of people that I have ever met. And they're also very motivated to change. And so when we're thinking about resiliency and how that impacts, people's lives and how do we build resiliency, I think we also have to remember that COVID is going to build resiliency, and that COVID is a stressor on many levels. It's multidimensional. It's a physical stressor, but it's also this mental health crisis that people are going through because of the uncertainty, because of having, to homeschool kids or work from home. It's a change in our structure and a change in our everyday life. And so I think that one of the things that we know for sure is that COVID is a major stressor, but it's also going to help us in terms of building emotional reserves, building that resiliency, and hopefully taking us into a better emotionally well place because we're working on that as we are in social isolation or quarantine or stay at home.
Over the past couple of months, we've heard a lot about the impact of the pandemic on our frontline workers. But one group of frontline workers that I think have largely been overlooked are family caregivers. In the best of circumstances, caregiving is a role that often carries added stress. And clearly, our current circumstances are not the best of circumstances. Even the standard sort of caregiver respite options aren't necessarily on the table right now. How do you see the COVID-19 pandemic affecting MS caregivers, and what steps can they take to care for themselves while still supporting their loved ones?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. So I think I'm going to start with a story, and I'm going to take you back to March when all of this was starting for the United States. And during that time, our practice, our behavioral medicine practice at Mellon Center, converted from what used to be 90% in-person visits to now 100% virtual visits. So it required a lot of leadership. It required a lot of decisions to be made. And this is pre having regulations or pre knowing what platforms we could use. And so my boss, Dr. Rob Bermel at the Mellon Center, would say on a regular basis, you know, if we're doing what's best for the patients, we're doing the best that we can in this situation. So we always made decisions and were empowered to make decisions, that we thought were best for the patients. And so that was really converting our practice to 100% virtual. And that included our fellows, and that included our entire behavioral medicine team. But the story that I'm going to tell is about a patient who has worked with us in our caregiver support group. And this group has become incredibly important to her. And so the first week, we did have to cancel the caregiver support group. And she wrote me in her medical record, in her MyChart, and she wrote me and she said, you know, this is something that I really rely on, this caregiver support group. I feel like I don't have any place to go right now in an incredibly stressful time where I'm really not even having a reprieve. I can't do the things that I would typically do. So at the very beginning, you know, she wasn't even walking or taking care of herself. And so she had asked me to reconsider starting the caregiver support group. And so, again, at that time, the virtual platforms were not real. They weren't sure what to use for our group platform. And so we finally figured it out in week two, and we had the caregiver support group. And it was incredible for our patients to be able to see each other virtually, of course, but also to connect and to know that they're all in this together and that they have people who are going through some similar things that they are going through at the same time. And so I felt like one of the things that we could offer was that ability to have that caregiver support group. I think to add to your question, what can caregivers do? So caregivers are really all of us right now. If we're at home or with our families or our children, or we're taking care of loved ones that need help, and even if they're not in our homes, we're still worried about people who are close to us or family members. And so we're doing things differently right now. And so one of the things that I think we have to keep in mind is the overall wellness approach. So when we think about wellness as an overall health behavior, you think about the fact that wellness requires people to do some form of movement. So exercise, yoga, walking, things that are virtual or outdoors and yet safe. We think about the fact that wellness includes nutrition. And so incorporating whole foods and cooking from home, which is what most people are doing right now. So they're probably have a leg up there. Wellness also includes sleep. So making sure that our sleep cycles are not adjusted. So going to bed at the same time and waking up at the same time is going to be incredibly important when you have all the time in the world. We also know that wellness includes spirituality. So for many people, there is a spiritual component or even a religious component. And so being able to really tap into that is going to be important. And then finally, taking care of your mental health and your stress management. So there are many ways that we can do that, but making sure that people's mental health is still intact.
I think that many people hope that as states lift their stay-at-home restrictions and stores, businesses, and restaurants all reopen, it's going to be a little like flipping a switch back to the way life was pre-COVID-19. But our public health experts have warned that it shouldn't be that way at all. Reopening is going to reopen a new chapter in the way we do a lot of everyday things that we've all been doing for our entire lives. And whether it's wearing masks when we're out with others or seeing our favorite restaurants open to reduced capacities with social distancing being maintained, or having that follow-up appointment with your neurologist possibly become a telemedicine appointment, Office floor plans might change. Flying on an airplane or even just going to the airport will be very different. To some degree, there's going to be a new normal that won't feel temporary. And we're all creatures of habit. Just changing long-held ingrained behaviors can create emotional dissonance for some people. Once it is safe, what are the best steps that people should take to prepare themselves for reentry?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think what we have to remember is that our new normal is going to look much different from the way that things looked in the past. And maybe that's a good thing. And so what I've heard, you know, I felt this myself, and I've heard this from friends and family and also my patients, is that perhaps we can gain something from this situation. This is unprecedented, but yet it's helping us to focus on what's important in our lives. So really honing in on those relationships, or honing in on things that are incredibly important to us, and letting go of some of the things that aren't so important to us. And so I think that we have to be okay with how we're feeling. So maybe if we want to stay at home and just focus on those relationships, that's fine. And we can't judge people. Everybody's going to have, again, their own risk tolerance for how they want to go about, reopening and how safe they feel. But from a psychological perspective, I think we have to give grace to where people are. And that is, you know, not judging and letting people figure out this, you know, this new normal on their own.
Well, Dr. Amy Sullivan, I want to thank you for all that you do every day to improve the lives of people affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. And John, thanks so much for giving me the platform. I know that you know this is incredibly important work to me. This is my passion. So thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of Real Talk MS by letting people know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/144. That's realtalkms.com/144. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I don't think I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified, and in some cases multiplied, the challenges of living with MS. From having difficulty affording MS medications, to adjusting to increased isolation, to coping with the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop. And neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can continue meeting the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and support groups so no one has to face MS alone. They serve as a reliable partner to navigate the challenges of COVID-19 and MS. They've created resources and provided information so that doctors and nurses can deliver the very best care to their patients. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical public policy decisions. And they've never stopped advancing research to find cures for MS. That's why I'm asking that, as we're able, each of us steps up and supports the National MS Society. To donate, you can text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. Or if you prefer, I've created an online shortcut to get you to that same webpage. So just visit realtalkms.com/COVID-19 Response Fund, and COVID-19 Response Fund is all one word, and make your donation. But however you choose to contribute, please contribute today. It's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.